Good day, listening public. Today is June 10th, 2020, and thank you for listening to General Disclosure, the podcast from SAN. My name is Dan Silverman, and I'm joined, as always, by co-host Cheryl Dowd. Cheryl, are you both present and accounted for?
I am present and accounted for. Hi, everyone.
Great. Today's guest is John Becker, who is a professor in the School of Education at Virginia Commonwealth University and has 12,000 Twitter followers. That alone is more than enough to get an invitation to General Disclosure. John is also the former director of online education at VCU, a lawyer and ed tech expert. He's also my friend and former boss, and sometimes it's just fun to talk to a friend. John, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. That is the longest intro we've ever had, so we're off to a good start or some kind of a start. I'll start you with the questions that we start everyone with, which is defining your career, your job in any way you'd like. Why do you do it? You could do a lot of things. Why do you do this?
Oh boy. I've always wanted to be in the world of compliance. No, that's not really true. But, and in fact, there's a certain irony there because I think the way I kind of live my life, the way my wife and I parent our kids is as much not about compliance as possible. And so it's funny that I'm talking to some folks who deal with compliance issues, but the true story is my mother is an educator, and so I think I was sort of drawn to education, but I also wanted to go to law school out of college. My mother knew, and so that was the path I was headed down, somewhere in the education law world, maybe juvenile justice, and didn't like law school very much, as most people don't or do. And took an education law class with Dr. Diana Pullen at Boston College. She became my mentor. We crafted a joint degree program. And from there, I got my law degree, but went into my doctoral program and just sort of knew that I wanted to be in the world of higher education, thinking, studying, researching, kind of living a life of the mind. And so that's how I think of the work that I do, is an opportunity to help the world and while also living a life of the mind.
If higher ed were to evaporate overnight, what would you do instead?
Wow. I don't cook that much and I don't cook that well, but I watch a lot of content on the Food Network. And I think it's because I believe that if, I don't think of it in terms of higher ed evaporating, but I think if I won the lottery and I didn't have to work, like, what would I do? And so I think I would go to culinary school and learn to cook. And as much as I know, like, the restaurant business is harsh and brutal, I think I'd like to go to culinary school. And so that would be kind of where I'd head.
Well, John, you don't have enough degrees, so you need more school. I think that's what everybody always says.
Exactly.
So since the COVID-induced shift to online learning, some SAN members are getting more acquainted with instructional design and ed tech. So what is the history of instructional designers and how does that change the role of a faculty member?
Yeah, I suspect a lot of people think instructional design is kind of a new field, but it's not really. And it even predates really sort of the distance education that we know now. We've been designing instruction face-to-face classrooms for a long time. And it's very much a, I would argue, a profession in that it has its own language, it has its own kind of entry points. And it is certainly seeing its time in the spotlight right now. And I don't track the classified ads much these days, but when I was in the last couple of years, I would say more than anything else, that's kind of where the need is around instructional design, and that even predates the coronavirus. As universities are scaling up online learning, one way to do that is to kind of build your own internal capacity, and that would be through hiring instructional designers.
So we hear a lot of acronyms. I'm going to give you three that some of our members might know, some of them might not, kind of a lightning acronym round. So LMS, OPM, and CMS.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with OPM because I want to link back to what I just said about instructional designers. As probably lots of your vast listening audience knows, if universities want to scale up their online programming, there are a few ways to do that. The two that are kind of most, I think, common are to build your own internal capacity to do that. And that's what I talked about in terms of instructional designers. So you hire instructional designers, you hire some technology folks, you hire maybe some video people, and of course a compliance person, can't forget that person. And you build up your own team to be able to scale up. One other way, is to hire what's known as an online program management company, or an OPM. And that's basically a third-party vendor, a for-profit vendor, who will sort of solve every problem that you have, or as they'll tell you, they'll solve problems you don't even know that you have. And the OPM field is diverse. There are companies that will do everything from soup to nuts for the university, anything from, you know, marketing to enrollment to course design, instructional design, to even teaching the courses. And then there's others. There's one called Noodle that VCU actually works with, and they are more like a general contractor, and they will help VCU figure out what needs they have, and then where they need to, will outsource that to a kind of subcontractor. So if, for example, if VCU decides they need help marketing their online programs, and Noodle doesn't have that capacity internally, they'll subcontract to a firm that does do marketing. So OPM is online program management. LMS is learning management system. And that is really software. And it's software that allows for courses to be built and delivered. And that is an interesting field as well. Maybe not quite as wide ranging as the OPM field, but for many years, the dominant LMS was Blackboard, and many universities would build courses in Blackboard. Blackboard's market share has dropped relatively dramatically in the last few years, and the new big player in the world is Instructure is the company, and their LMS is called Canvas. And in fact, VCU right now is in the midst of transitioning from Blackboard to Canvas. So we'll be spending this coming academic year transitioning all of our courses that are in Blackboard into Canvas. And there are also LMS, there's open source LMS like Moodle, which requires a little more internal capacity to run. But that's what an LMS is, a learning management system. And then a CMS, go ahead, Dan.
No, I took it away. There's still one more.
Yeah, the CMS, which is not something I work with as much, but sort of it stands for Content Management System. And there's, in my mind at least, there's not a lot of sort of agreement exactly what falls within the category of CMS, but I know WordPress is considered a CMS because it allows for website building. And at VCU, as Dan knows, we had a significant WordPress installation where any faculty member, staff, or student could create their own website through our installation of WordPress. It was a content management system for folks who wanted to build stuff on the web within VCU. So that's what content management system stands for. How'd I do? Did I pass?
I think so. So what are some, I think you started getting there with WordPress, but are there other alternatives, LMSs, particularly for folks at institutions that haven't done a lot of this quickly and don't necessarily want or can afford a full boat like that?
You mean a CMS or LMS?
To an LMS.
I'm not entirely familiar with the kind of financial aspects of it, but Moodle is probably less money initially because it requires the university to do a lot of the technical work. They have to host it themselves and they manage it themselves. Whereas Blackboard and Canvas, Blackboard used to be like a VCU, we hosted our own installation of Blackboard, but pretty much as a lot of things move to the cloud, most universities transition to having Blackboard host it for them. And this, it works the same way with Canvas. So universities are kind of less out of the business of the technical side of running servers and all that sort of stuff. And that's now all done offsite and in the cloud with the companies themselves.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and Cheryl, jump in whenever you'd like to. What's a fact about online learning that state authorization people might not know but should?
A fact about online learning. For me, one of the challenges in talking about online learning is that it's not as monolithic as people, I think, believe. So Dan knows when we worked together, one of the great challenges we had was in creating definitions around online learning so that we could both collect data and information and also kind of report out information. And so, you know, the powers that be at VCU would say to me, you know, how many online programs do we have? Seems like a really simple question. I should be able to say we have 11 online programs, but what is an online program? And so the example we would give is we have an actual program at VCU where every semester in the program, every course in the program that's offered is offered as two sections, a face-to-face course and an online course. And students could choose, you know, if they're taking three courses in a semester, they could choose to take two of them face-to-face and one online. They could take them all online. And that's true throughout the life of their program. So the question is, is that an online program? You'd have to sort of define it. Is it a student who completes more than 50% of the coursework online? They've completed the, point is like this thing called online learning is not a thing. It's not monolithic. There's many variations to it. It's hard to define. And I suspect for regulators and state authorization folks, that's a little frustrating, but I'm not sure there's really any way around it.
You've done some work too on where students take online courses in terms of, if I live in Virginia, I'm most likely to be taking online courses from where?
Yeah, and I continue to do that work. And I remember early on when I was the director of online learning, reading or hearing somewhere that something like 90% of students in online courses live within 10 miles of their institution, something like that. And it was this kind of myth that went around the world of distance education and nobody was ever really able to track it down. But I have been looking at iPads data to try and get a sense of, iPads data in combination with the SARA data to take a look at enrollments in out-of-state versus in-state, which is an issue obviously for compliance folks for state authorization reasons, but it's also a big issue, especially now as universities are looking to generate increased revenue. You know, out-of-state students are like, they're gold. And so every university wants to, develop online programs where they can increase enrollment of out-of-state students because they have to pay more money. And I think it's chasing sort of a pot of gold to the end of the rainbow that doesn't really exist.
Cheryl, did that ring any bells for you with the use of the SARA data?
I just think it's all very interesting as institutions are figuring out their reporting mechanisms to know what they're reporting. Because I think that that's really, not only has there been an increase perhaps of participation, but also institutions understanding how to do good reporting. So I think all of that is converging. So it's going to be very interesting. And I know I've had conversations with Russ, and maybe you all have too, about, you know, the structure of IPEDS and, you know, how it's due for a revamp. You know, for to make sure that the data is good. And so I'm also interested in seeing Sarah data down the road to watch how experiential learning across state lines is occurring. And if there are, you know, what kind of increases, decreases, stability, you know, how does that actually look once institutions are really comfortable in tracking that and then sharing it out? So.
And Cheryl, when we're offline, maybe, I don't know if he's told you these stories, but Dan has some really fun stories about trying to get people in VCU to give us data about experiential learning.
I can understand. Yep. I think all of us that have done this with institutions before have had, you know, interesting conversations. So I look forward to talking to Dan about some specific stories. That sounds good.
I mean, I sort of distinctly remember him sort of coming to my office once and saying, I just had a conversation with so-and-so in unit, whatever unit within the university. They don't know where their students are doing experience, you know.
Right.
Yeah. They don't know? Yeah, no, the students just kind of sign up and do it. And yeah, I'm sure a lot of your folks you work with deal with that kind of issue.
Well, it's funny too, if you live in a tri-state area too, because, you know, people say, well, I just went over the river. I just crossed the bridge. Well, is it a different state over there? I'm like, oh yeah, it is. So anyway, but it's understandable. I mean, especially when you live in a tri-state area, you sometimes kind of think of it as one region. And so you don't necessarily take it to the next step about state oversight. So.
John, another area you teach higher ed law, school law. Is there a case that we should know about that we don't? Something recent, something interesting?
Good question. Related to sort of distance education or just in general?
Anything really.
I teach with a particular focus on kind of civil rights and civil liberties and kind of the constitutional laws applied to education. And I just happened to be reading an article this morning about the wall between this proverbial wall between church and state is just, it's not just being chipped away at, it's almost invisible at this point. And so I continue to track those kind of issues, but the big one that we're waiting for any day now, literally any day now, we're going to get a Supreme Court ruling on Title VII and how we, you know, define what is meant by because of sex in Title VII, and is do the protections of Title VII cover gender identity and sexual orientation?
That is what case was that? I haven't been following that.
Oh boy. It was actually the combination of three cases. One of them happened to be that, you know, sort of education law, because it's about like a skydiving instructor. So it's got some educational implications. But I mean, Title VII has huge implications for everybody, obviously, and certainly. And any workplace that has, you know, the right number of people, Title VII is going to apply. And so it's I wake up every morning, 10 o'clock, you know, waiting, peeking through my fingers to see if the Supreme Court has issued the ruling or not. It's coming any day now.
Cheryl, do you have any other follow-ups for John?
I have just been fascinated by this discussion today. So thank you very much, John, for sharing, you know, how your perspective is after you've been working through these experiences at an institution and with your education experience. So thank you very much for all of this.
Yeah, and you know, I just want to add a little, well, not maybe not funny, but funny to me story that I'm sure all the people who might listen to this could understand, which is, when I first took the job as the director of online programs at VCU, I was appointed on an interim basis. We'd hired someone, she left 4 months into the job. And so I came in on an interim basis and showed up to where my new office was, and it was completely empty except for a giant binder on my desk. And What do you think that binder was? It was the state authorization binder.
Oh, boy.
And it was literally, it had like a laminated folder for each state.
Yep.
With a copy of the letter that had been sent to every state. And these were kind of early days of state authorization, you know, predating SARA and all that kind of stuff. And like my boss said, you know, there's your first challenge. And I had to learn a lot. And that's why I hired Dan, and I could just pass the binder off to him.
That's great. I created a binder too. And I would do a happy dance when the certificate would arrive from the state or the letter. Cause I was almost disappointed if they only sent me an email, you know. I loved those certificates. That was fun. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, those binders had they were physical and metaphorical objects. Weren't
yeah. They? Yeah. Yes, they that's were. True. Oh my goodness.
Well, John, thank you so much. We really have learned a lot. Is there anything else that I missed or that you were hoping to get your two cents on?
No, am I going to get like walk-up music for this? Do I get to pick my walk-up music?
If you can edit the podcast and put it in, otherwise,
we're still learning. We're less than a year into doing this, so we've really moved forward with the tools that we use, which I'm pleased for. But Dan keeps adding new little pieces, so it's great.
Good. I think I'm only sort of, I'm dabbling in the world of podcasts, but it does seem like they all follow a very similar format, which is like, you know, something humorous up front and then the intro music and then they start in. So if you can invent a different format, that would be great.
Yeah. Format's all good. Right. Well, speaking of that, that's a good segue actually to my new segment. I'm taking a little break from regulation of the month and a little segment I'm calling Out of Left Field, which is where I find some object in the rest of my life and see how, unfortunately, it ends up relating back to higher regulation or state auth more specifically, depending on what it is. So this month, I was reading the book, Can I Play Two by Mo Willems, which is a children's book. Although, if you were to ask Mo Willems, he would say no. He claims that he doesn't write children's books just because they're illustrated and follow the same number of pages and I mean, no one would think they're not a children's book, but he's an interesting guy. Anyway, what this book is about, the two characters, and don't worry, I won't give away the ending, but Elephant and Piggy are trying to play catch. They're throwing the ball back and forth. Their friend Snake comes along and wants to play too. Snake, however, does not have arms. And so they go through a few different guesses about how to play catch with a snake. This book really is about universal design and learning and how accessibility, if done right, it's an argument that accessibility done right can actually make the whole game better. But I won't ruin the ending for those of you who want to read it. So
is it a story about sort of offering a reasonable accommodation to the snake?
I'd say, John, they go beyond their legal duty to offer reasonable accommodation.
Okay.
They even make a fundamental alteration of the game, but yet they still have fun. So, but maybe just a reasonable accommodation. Actually, that's a good, well, I don't want to give it away. So, maybe next time I'll pick back up on that. Cheryl, can you read it between now and then, you think?
I look forward to reading it between now and then.
Okay, so then we can discuss whether it's a reasonable accommodation or a fundamental alteration of the game. So that is my new segment, Out of Left Field. But that brings us back to everybody's favorite, which is Cheryl on Musicals. Now, Cheryl, we've talked about a lot of the basics over this last year, and with Broadway and all of its cousins dark, it's a little harder. But I have a couple questions for you. Have you read anything recently, whether a book or an article or an ad for turkeys that you think would make a good musical?
Are you saying a story or a movie or something that should
that
be
you think
turned
would
into
make, yeah, that could be turned into one. Yeah.
Well, there are all kinds of odd things that have been turned into musicals. I never thought that I would see Beetlejuice, the musical. And because I saw the movie Beetlejuice a million years ago, and I never would have thought, add music. That's what it was missing. And then again, I understand that it did pretty well for its short run before things went dark. And then, you know, of course, SpongeBob was nominated for a Tony, and I wouldn't have expected that. I think that they're always looking, they're currently looking at movies these days to try to turn them in, to try to reach the public in some areas that they think that they might enjoy the topic area. I know there's been talk of, now this isn't a turkey, but actually I'm looking forward to this. There was a TV show called Smash that lasted for 2 years, and they're talking about making that into a movie musical. It was a TV show. It was a Spielberg TV show, actually, that was about the development of Broadway musicals and the people that were a part of that. And it only lasted 2 years, but now they're talking about making it into a musical. So I think that there's rich content everywhere, and there are talented people out there who can turn it into some sort of on stage production. I look forward to seeing what they're doing. I think the one I'm looking most forward to right now is, again, not a turkey, but it was something from our past, is Hercules. Hercules, the Disney movie, there was a stage adaptation that was kind of tested out last summer, did very well. And so there is talk of that being on its road to Broadway. So looking forward to that. That didn't answer your question at all.
but that's okay. I was looking at our Podbean listener statistics, and it might surprise you that the plurality of our downloads come from Utah. And so I want to craft some Utah-based content here. Cheryl, have you ever seen a musical either about Utah or that took place in Utah? Have you theater in Utah? What about Utah musicals can you possibly say?
Wow, that's very interesting.
Well, I mean, is Book of Mormon too easy?
Well, there you go. I know. Those guys are from Colorado, but that's okay.
Yeah, there's a connection, I think.
Well, there you go. I think one of the most enjoyable musical experiences that I've had was I got to see the Mormon Tabernacle Choir Christmas show last year. I was out in Salt Lake City working with the Utah Sarah Institutions, and I got to see the show, and it was just kind of, I was just overwhelmed by how beautiful it was. And then a musical theater person, Kelly O'Hara, beautiful actress, was their main person for the show. So anyway, they love, you know, they're very strong performing artists out there in Utah. I mean, think of the Osmonds.
Yeah, John, do you have any Utah performance art?
Well, no, but I mean, the Book of Mormons was recently in Richmond at our local kind of musical theater venue, and we saw it, and I enjoyed it a lot. I recommend it.
It is a good show.
Yeah.
It's really funny because I went to the show with lower expectations and kind of was surprised by how really good it was. I mean, the content was not just, okay, so my boys like South Park, so I was expecting South Park, honestly. And I thought that it was much deeper than I was going to give it credit for. But I thought, you know, it did a pretty good job.
Yep.
And very talented performers.
Maybe South Park is deeper than you're giving it credit for.
Yeah, there could be that.
But if you'll indulge me, I could wrap this whole conversation with a nice bow. Ready?
Yes. Okay,
please do.
So a little bit of a pitch. I've been, my daughter and I watch a show on NBC called Songland. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yep.
And I love it. And I think I love it because it sort of reminds me of instructional design work, because you get to see how a song is made. The premise is that these songwriters come on every week. There's a new artist, and then four songwriters come on and pitch a song to the artist for the artist, and then three of the four songwriters get to work with three famous music producers to craft the song in a way that's better for the particular artist. And then the artist picks the winner and then records that songwriter's song. And throughout the show, you see them, the whole process of how a song gets made. And it's a real interesting look kind of inside the black box of how a song gets made. So as someone who likes instructional design work, I think that's why I enjoy the show. So the way I'm going to sort of tie this all together is that it's on Monday nights. This coming Monday night, the artist is Ben Platt, who played the original Evan Hansen in Dear Evan Hansen. And I had the distinct pleasure of seeing the original cast of Dear Evan Hansen when it was like the first month of production. And it was really, it's a moving show and a really wonderful musical. If folks have never seen it, I really encourage you to check it out. So there you go. Instructional design.
Love it.
And musical theater all wrapped up into one.
We really can't do any better than John. Thank you so much.
That was fantastic.
Thanks to everybody who listens, especially our friends in Utah. And yes, we'll see you next month.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having me.